We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, August 28th, and the top headline this morning is that Special Counsel Jack Smith, prosecutors, and the DOJ file another indictment against Donald Trump, but this is not in addition. This is a superseding indictment. So what this means is that in light of the Supreme Court opinion on immunity and that a president, including Donald Trump, has immunity for official acts and other non-official acts such as campaign-related activity are not covered by immunity, then they have to go back. The DOJ has to go back and look at their initial indictment and say, is there anything in there that would be covered by immunity? And so rather than having a fact-finding process at the trial court level initially, what they did after the Supreme Court issued that opinion was go back to a brand new grand jury and submit a brand new indictment that now supersedes or replaces the original one that is a little bit less. And so it's only 36 pages compared to about 45 pages. There are a few things that were excised from the original indictment, including the allegations with Jeff Clark, who was in the DOJ at the time. And so what obviously the Jack Smith prosecutors are hoping for is that this new superseding indictment will not run afoul of the Supreme Court opinion and that they can still pursue their case against Donald Trump. So, of course, the mainstream media yesterday was, you know, saying, oh, this is, you know, well done, Jack Smith, and they're lauding this, of course. And on CNN, oh, our friends over at CNN, Ty Cobb, who is a former Trump White House attorney. So, you know, this is not somebody who is a leftist. He actually said that he thinks that on this new indictment, Trump will get 6 to 9 years. Listen to this, cut six.
As you point out, I mean, this is a very forceful document. It's pared down. Every sentence is, you know, crisply worded. It's a tight narrative. You can't read this and not understand the crimes that Trump actually committed. And you, as you pointed out, 55 years is exposure. He's not going to get 55 years, but he'll get 6 to 9 on this.
All right. Well, let's welcome in a great expert on the topic, our good friend Abraham Hamilton III, who is general counsel and does so much here at the American Family Association. And I always appreciate his opinions. And he's also on the Hamilton Corner each and every weekday here on American Family Radio Network. So good morning, Abe. And what did you think about the superseding indictment? Will this satisfy the Supreme Court immunity requirements?
You know, I heard that clip from Ty Cobb. Good morning, by the way. And it just makes you wonder, is he truly providing legal analysis or does he want Trump to serve 6 to 9 years in prison? As you know, I practiced criminal law for a decade and I handled major felony offenses. It's the absurdity of continuously asserting that you have first offender with no criminal history, that they automatically will serve prison time. That just defies the logic of any criminal law practitioner's experience. Now, I understand this is a unique circumstance. We've never had a president indicted for activities during office. I get all of that. But I just think these people are so craven, many of them, and I don't know Mr. Kyle personally, but many of them are so craven, I think it belies any capacity for objectivity sometimes. Now, putting that aside, I still believe that there is a question that remains to be seen as to whether or not this pared-down indictment actually satisfies the Supreme Court's immunity decision. And I also believe that it creates an opportunity, and I'm not sure how far this would go, but creates an opportunity for Justice Clarence Thomas's dissent in the Trump immunity, not dissent, his concurrence in the Trump immunity decision to be brought to a higher level. In particular, he brought to the fore the question as to whether or not our Constitution still governs an appointment of an office of special counsel in order to bring these types of prosecutions. This is the same type of rationale that Judge Eileen Cannon in Florida employed when she dismissed the documents case. You know, so I'm not as confident as Mr. Cobb that this, you know, satisfies a threading of the needle or things of that nature, because it's the same issues, the same indictment. They removed a DOJ employee from the indictment, which brings to the fore, well, why did you include him initially if you were so confident in that? So you removed that in order to try to make it more squarely evident that this was an unofficial act of the presidency. But I think an argument still exists to say that a president has the lawful authority to see to it that an election complies with constitutional measures. And I think that would still fall clearly within the official responsibilities of a sitting president, which would also then go to the fact that there is immunity available for official acts.
Yeah, and so well said. And I think that when we look at the mainstream media, whether it's Fox News or CNN or kind of anywhere in between, maybe, you know, whether it's the DNC's PR camp or the Republicans' PR camp, there is a lot of breaking opinion instead of breaking news when they're talking about some of these cases. And it's more of the outcome that they prefer rather than saying, okay, let's set aside our bias either way for or against Trump and actually look at what the law does and also should require. And so even for the immunity case, Abe, I mean, I thought that the Supreme Court got it right, not because it was for or against Trump in that respect, but because it was for the Constitution and for the office of the presidency. It just makes sense that sitting presidents should have immunity from the DOJ or state level prosecutors for official acts. And yet that's not even something that it seems like our country can agree on, because there is so much myopic focus on whether or not we like or approve of the individual Donald Trump and his administration.
It's so well said. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the formula for the decimation of our constitutional republic in this glorious experiment in individual liberty. We have to have the capacity to be adults, to set aside personal biases and even emotional fervor and look objectively at the office of the president that is going to be here long after there's no Donald Trump running for office, long after there's no Biden. We hope long after there's no persons running for office. And as I referred to earlier, Justice Thomas referred to the founders' recognition that we needed to have an energetic executive. We need to have an executive that has the full scope of capacity to execute constitutional duties. No American citizen should want presidents criminally prosecuted for official acts. No American citizen should want that. Nor should we want presidents to have blanket carte blanche to do anything in their personal capacity that's beyond being held accountable. And I agree with you, it struck the appropriate balance because of the office of the president and our desire to maintain constitutional order. We have to get out of this knee-jerk reactionary phase to where our opinions are governed only, exclusively, or primarily by emotional passions connected to a person or a personality. It has to have foundational fidelity to the constitutional structure and constitutional order for our nation.
I'm speaking with Abraham Hamilton III, who's the host of the Hamilton Corner here on American Family Radio Network, and is one of the shows that I listen to all the time because I just so appreciate your insight, your legal analysis, and also your pastoral messages that you always begin with. They're always so encouraging to me, Abe. And I know that, you know, you and I talk offline quite a bit about, you know, some of the constitutional principles, you know, the legal issues that are going on. And what you just said really is a matter of principle. And this is why the Supreme Court precedent ultimately matters, because it's not just about the outcome related to Donald Trump and this specific instance. This is about the country moving forward. And this is what I see as the worldview difference and distinction between Democrats that use lawfare to manipulate the law for the outcome-driven purposes that they want to achieve versus a principled constitutional originalist like a Justice Thomas, for example, that says we need to make sure that the law applies equally and fairly, not for everyone, but also that the principle of the precedent is good for the future of the nation. And we need to all rise above the partisan politicking and understand that this is why the Supreme Court matters, why judicial appointments matter, and ultimately why we need to conserve our U.S. Constitution and its principles. So with all of this, where do you see this new superseding indictment going? I think that the Trump team is still going to file their motions to dismiss based on the Supreme Court immunity case. There's still going to be that fact-finding at the trial court level, but then there can be appeals, right? So I don't think that this is going to necessarily be resolved anytime soon.
No, I agree with you. I really believe this is more of a face-saving effort than it is an objective pursuit of justice by Jack Smith and the Department of Justice, because they won't be able to get anything done prior to the November election concerning this particular case. They're going to be the regular processes, as you mentioned. There's availability of interlocutory appeals. And so I believe this is nothing more and Jack Smith attempting to save face in light of being rebuked by the Supreme Court and taking into consideration that, you know, the Washington, D.C. jurisdiction is quite favorable to persecutions and prosecution of President Trump. And I think that is what's motivating this more than anything, because, I, as you mentioned, I think the immunity decision actually got it right for constitutional fidelity and what's necessary for our nation going forward beyond the persona of President Trump. And I understand that people have a hard time seeing that because we've never had a sitting president indicted for anything for the actions taken during the presidency. So because he's the person that brought this issue to the fore, it doesn't change and it shouldn't change the constitutional analysis. And so with the entire process that's going to play out, the Trump team, they are going to file their motions to dismiss in light of the Supreme Court immunity decision. And so this is going to drag out far beyond the election. And I think once the election is over, the concern about this prosecution is going to wane in the eyes of the public. And I also believe it's going to wane in the eyes of the Department of Justice. And if President Trump is reelected, then that will completely change because the Department of Justice will change based on President Trump's appointments.
Yeah, I could not agree more with you. And you people forget that that all of these cases at the trial court level and all the way up started with a person, with an event, with facts that and allegations that happened that lead to precedent. And, you know, 100 years from now, if there is still such a thing as the United States of America, people and lawyers will be so much more focused on the precedent value than they will about the people involved. I mean, we use case names all the time that refer to the individuals that are the parties of the cases, and so many times we just focus on the precedential value, forgetting that it started with a fact pattern, started with somebody, you know, doing or not doing something that gave rise to ultimately this case or controversy that goes before the Supreme Court. So well after Donald Trump and his time in national politics and the media, we will have a really good precedent on immunity for sitting presidents. But the last question on this topic, and then I want to turn to another issue with you, Abe, is doesn't this whole lawfare scope overall, doesn't this encourage future presidents, though, to simply just pardon themselves and everybody on their way out of office to avoid these types of situations in the future?
Yeah, it does. And that's not what we should want as the American people, frankly, because, you know, it's the same old adage. And what you mentioned earlier was so accurate about really this craven desire to hold on to power that often comes from people on the Democrat side of our body politic. Because remember, it was the Democrats and Harry Reid that initially changed the filibuster rules concerning judicial nominees. And they did it for lower federal court nominees, but not the Supreme Court, okay? And then the Republicans responded in kind and said, hey, we're going to do it for the Supreme Court. Oh, it was wailing and gnashing of teeth. We can't believe the Republicans doing this. And the guys, you are the ones that are moving to continually politicize these features of our government only when it benefits you. It is the Supreme Court. If you remember with the Bork time period, the 80s and up to the 90s, well, for the Democrats, the Supreme Court is this hallowed institution. And now that you have different appointments taking place, now they want to return to the FDR vision of packing the court. You see that happening over and over and over again. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is that we have to get out of this place where it's just reactionary, you know, politics. We have to understand that there's a republic that we should want to conserve. There's a republic we should want to endure. This enjoyment of individual liberty is an aberration in human history. Are we willing to just filter that away just because of our emotional investment in personas and personalities? It's an unwise and myopic disposition. But unfortunately, that seems to be the thing that's governing today. And so when you have the lawfare applied and imposed upon a president, it just sets the stage for subsequent presidents to further, in my view, demean the office and politicize it and just say, hey, I'm just going to park myself on the way out the door and just to avoid these things from happening to me and other future presidents.
Yeah, so well said. I'm speaking with Abraham Hamilton III from the American Family Association. His show is Hamilton Corner. You can also follow him on X at Hamilton Corner, and you should because he posts a lot of great content. And you know, speaking of conserving this republic, and this used to be the unanimous vision, it wasn't just so siloed into the two-party fidelity system that we find ourselves in now in 2024, where it seems to just be a clash of parties instead of a common vision of unity for creating a more perfect union. We now have, as Christians, an opportunity, I think, to draw back to worldview and say, what is our Judeo-Christian heritage? What is the Western tradition that has led to this aberration of freedom and the most prosperous society in human history because we're founded on self-government? I mean, all of these principles. And as Christians, we should be focused on that much more than partisan party politics or personalities, as you mentioned, Abe. But there is this very interesting group, and there was an opinion piece from MSNBC titled, "How I've Been Convincing Christians They Don't Have to Vote Republican. Democrats Need to Embrace the Idea that Evangelicals, especially white male evangelicals, are worth winning and can be won." So this goes on to talk about the group Evangelicals for Harris, which is a social media group on X. But basically, Abe, the premise is that Christians, there is an argument that Christians can vote for Kamala Harris's policies, which equate to communism and Marxism. And that, to me, just fundamentally is incompatible with the biblical worldview. So is there an argument that we can convince Christians that, hey, you don't have to vote for originalism, you can go ahead and vote for communism?
I don't think there's a Christian argument that can be made. There are political arguments that are being made to Christians, though. and so the overarching, I guess, thesis for these organizations that has a theological imprimatur, if you will, is that we don't have a works-based salvation, which is absolutely right. Christians, we are saved by grace through faith. We are not, our salvation is not based on works at all. So a work would be construed as, well, if I do this, if I vote a certain way, does that mean I'm Christian? However, what the Lord does convey is that though we do not have a works-based salvation, because we are regenerate, because we are born again, we do produce certain works. Those works are not produced in order to earn salvation, in order to earn justification, but they are the byproduct that flow from a person who has been captured by Christ. That being said, the Christian is commanded by the Lord to refuse to be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. We have a duty to evaluate everything that we do, everything that we believe, everything that we engage in through the white-hot lens of the scripture scrutiny. So the believer's evaluation metric should be, am I walking as closely as possible and obeying what God commands me as I discharge my civic duty? So while I agree, the Christian faith doesn't dictate in order to be justified that you vote a certain way, but the Christian faith does say, refuse to conform and to embrace the unfruitful works of darkness, rather expose them. I don't see anywhere in scripture where it would say, hey, vote for the person who wants to mutilate children's bodies. I don't see anywhere in scripture where the God says, hey, vote for a person who wants to forcibly confiscate your neighbor's wealth and possessions and property and redistribute it according to a Marxist standpoint. And so to get right down to it, what it requires, though, is for believers to not only have a biblical worldview, but to apply what Peter said, that we are always ready to give a biblical reason for the hope that we have and for why we engage. And so for too long, too many Christians have been able to go along unthinkingly about these things. But now we're in the place with movies like this, Evangelicals for Harris, that we need to truly and honestly reflect on what God requires of us and whether or not we're walking as closely as possible to Scripture, or are we straying away from Scripture as we engage civically.
So well said. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Thanks so much, Abe. If ending babies' lives in their mother's womb isn't heartbreaking enough, the Biden-Harris administration punishes those who protect life, including up to 10 years in jail. In a shocking stance, the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, supports infanticide, meaning the death of newborns. When will this madness end? Preborn's network of clinics is positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country, on standby to protect and love mothers facing unplanned pregnancies. By introducing a woman to her baby through ultrasound and showering her with God's love, her baby's chance at life doubles. But they can't do it without our help. If you are pro-life, please consider a donation of any size to support the mission of Preborn. All gifts are tax deductible and will help defend the defenseless. One ultrasound is just $28, or five ultrasounds is $140. $5,000 will sponsor ultrasounds for Preborn's entire network for a full day. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR, preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And Daily Wire is reporting that Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg said in a letter on Monday to the House Judiciary Committee, including Chairman Jim Jordan, that the Biden-Harris administration repeatedly pressured his company, which includes Facebook, Instagram, Messenger, WhatsApp, and more, to censor content that is protected free speech. Remember, this was in the aftermath of COVID and during the and leading up to the 2020 election, including the New York Post story about the Hunter Biden laptop that was suppressed. So Zuckerberg made the admission in a letter to the House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan this week, in which he said his goal moving forward was to, quote, be neutral and not play a role one way or another, unquote, for either political party or ideology. He said he doesn't even want the appearance of playing a role and will not be making political contributions. And that supposedly includes the whole Zuckerbucks controversy that there's been a lot of litigation on. He said that the company made a mistake by temporarily demoting that New York Post story during the 2020 election about Hunter Biden's laptop after officials, mostly from the FBI, falsely suggested that it was part of a Russian disinformation operation. So the timing of this is very interesting, but it also raises the question that if Zuckerberg is telling the truth to Jim Jordan in this letter, then this would be the complete opposite testimony than what Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas provided in 2022 to Congress in front of Senator Josh Hawley. Listen to this exchange, Cut 7.
We have example after example of this administration coordinated, apparently, according to a federal court, by your agency, pressuring, coercing social media companies to engage in censorship. Is that constitutional?
That is unequivocally false.
Is what the emails show?
It is unequivocally false, Senator.
You are not pressuring the big tech companies to take down accounts. You are not meeting with them to ask them to censor on your behalf.
That is correct. We are not.
Let's welcome in Jake Denton, who is a tech reporter at Heritage, the Heritage Foundation. And Jake, what do you make of this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, we've seen since the Twitter files first broke that this is a problem that's really running rampant in Silicon Valley. Facebook, Meta is not alone in their correspondence with government and bending the knee to the censorship request. But, you know, Zuckerberg's whole kind of vibe change and coming off as this, like, you know, victim here, I think is really just kind of a PR play. I don't actually think he's, you know, that upset about what happened to him. He spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to, you know, sway the election. I'm sure he was pretty much happy to go along with the censorship request as well. So I think this is really just kind of a PR move. I don't think there's really any remorse. And I think the censorship's probably going to continue. It'll just look a little different.
Well, and so why admit this now? I mean, this is the last week of August, heading into a presidential election in November. Why draw attention to this now?
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of conspiracy theories floating around. I think it's the best way you could describe them. Some have suggested, you know, maybe there's a whistleblower that's, you know, on the sidelines waiting to come forward with something. He's trying to preempt that. Maybe he's, you know, had a genuine change of heart. That's a little more believable, I suppose, than the whistleblower at this time. And then, you know, there's also just the whole idea of, you know, maybe there's a regime change. Maybe, you know, the guy that he really did a disservice to by, you know, basically nuking all conservative content off the platform is going to come back into office and really not be too happy with how things went the last time around. And he's trying to maybe make up for some space there. But it's really probably too early to tell here. And all honesty, you know, with the way these stories go, this is probably gone by next week. None of us will be talking about this. It'll just, you know, be another news cycle. He's probably just hedging a little bit here. And I think that's hard for a lot of people to, you know, factor in, but that's probably the reality. I don't think there's a whole lot here.
Yeah. And you know, this kind of struck me. And again, you know, this is just my view of kind of the landscape here, that he's putting this out to the House Judiciary Committee to go on record before this election and saying, hey, I'm not doing anything, so that maybe if there are any irregularities and other things in this election, he can say, hey, look, I already told you guys back in August, I'm not doing anything. You know, don't come after me, basically. But then also it struck me that as X, the new Twitter, and Elon Musk rises as the free speech, non-censorship platform, that's taking away a lot of attention from Meta. So could this just be a business move as well?
I think, you know, that's definitely a fair read of the situation. You and I have talked about this previously on a past show, but, you know, the censorship model has kind of changed over the years, especially since the COVID days. It's a lot less about, you know, suspensions and shadow bans and these types of things, and really just limiting the visibility of posts on feed. It's that whole freedom of speech, not freedom of reach principle. So more of a censoring of who is able to see what you're saying, less, you know, censorship on what you actually say. And I think that's a lot harder to detect. You know, you still get the views, you still get the likes. They're just not coming from a relevant audience. And I think, you know, Meta is pretty much able to execute that at scale. No one really audits their likes or their impressions. And everyone just seems, you know, happy. You know, censorship's not happening anymore. Conservatives made a big fuss over bans, and it was bad PR for Facebook. And you know, now they're able to basically do it and everyone's happy. And I think that's probably more what's going to happen this time around in this election cycle. A lot harder to detect, still, you know, encourages ad spends and influencer buys, but still has a devastating impact on our ability to reach, you know, conservatives.
I'm speaking with Jake Denton, who is a tech policy advisor for the Heritage Foundation, and this Mark Zuckerberg letter to the House Judiciary Committee. So while this is all going on, and we've covered previously on a segment with you about the digital ad spends and how much of an increase that is looking to be for the 2024 election, even than the 2020 and prior elections, as more and more people are getting their news from digital sources, from social media. So while all of that is going on, is there opportunity perhaps for Congress to follow up on Secretary Mayorkas? He was impeached over the border, and then of course the Senate, you'll recall, just voted that down. They didn't even care to hold hearings or do any sort of fact-finding at a trial in the U.S. Senate. But is this potentially something that could open a reconsideration of looking at Secretary Mayorkas for something like perjuring himself, for example, in the clip that we just played with his exchange with Senator Hawley?
I mean, they absolutely should, but, you know, this is coming rather late in this Congress, you know, unbeknownst to, you know, those outside of D.C., Congress is on recess for pretty much all of October, and then, boom, we have the election right, you know, that first week of November. So we're pretty much in a lame duck session now. It'll have to be next Congress, and who's really to say what the makeup of next Congress will be. But I think it kind of emphasizes a more important point of, like, we can't just wait around every time we get in a majority to do these things towards the final stretch. You know, we had 2 years to do things like this, and we didn't do any of them. You know, it really took a long time to get the wheels turning on this. And now, you know, here we are waiting for the election. So I think, you know, next time around, we really got to be adamant that this action happens in the early days of next Congress rather than waiting towards the end.
Yeah, isn't it so like Republicans to just wait and wait and delay and then say, oh, hey, you know, sorry, we're out of time. But interestingly, Congressman Andy Biggs said on this show that even with that report for the impeachable offenses of a sitting President Joe Biden, I mean, allegedly he's still, and I think technically our current sitting president, even though he's not really doing anything. But that report, of course, comes, you know, years delayed, but that Speaker Mike Johnson is actually considering filing impeachment articles, but after the November election so that it doesn't look like, you know, partisan politicking. And I have no doubt that if that ends up happening, then the Senate will just do the same thing and vote it down and not even contemplate it. And there's probably not going to be a whole lot of accountability, unfortunately, for Joe Biden. But I want to ask you also, Jake Denton, about, you know, speaking of visibility and censorship and some of these algorithms where it's not as obvious, because you have to have your posts visible for people to engage with your content. And so visibility matters. Elon Musk has been very open about a lot of what X is doing on the platform, but sometimes it seems that he's almost overemphasizing some of the algorithms rather than just saying, hey, we're going to take off, you know, all throttling, all boosting, all algorithms, and just kind of let the free market naturally decide whose content is amplified. He posted this 3 days ago on his X. He said, we, meaning X, we are working on highlighting more banger content from currently smaller X accounts. Our current algorithm shows too much from accounts that are big already. What did you make of that change to the algorithm?
Well, it's something that I think X desperately needs. If you go to your For You page, you know, your main feed, you basically see the same 10 to 15 accounts every day. You know, it's really hard to break out of your content window. The algorithm is basically clumping you into a persona type and then just bombarding you with what they think you're looking for. And it really makes it hard to find interesting commentary that we used to go to X or Twitter for. The feed has just been tinkered with so much that, you know, every week you log in and you don't really know what you're going to expect. But we've been trapped in this dynamic for months. You know, I'll tweet and I get 12 impressions. It's impossible to get any views. So I think it is pretty important that he starts to prioritize smaller accounts or the smaller accounts go away. You know, if you don't get impressions, people leave. So you need to encourage smaller accounts that, you know, gain some traction, continue to post. Otherwise, it's just 10 to 15 accounts running the whole platform.
Yeah. And you know, there are a lot of issues with the For You feed. And I experienced that on my own social media that it's just, you know, kind of a regular cadre of a few accounts and, you know, and some that I want to see because it's either good content or they're people that I know personally that I like their content. But I do want to see, you know, other things and other things even that I disagree with. I mean, it's not a good thing to just be so artificially confined to your own perspective that it becomes an kind of these manufactured echo chambers across the board. But is there a concern that with amplifying smaller accounts, then you run into some of these types of visibility issues that shouldn't be there, in the sense that if you're prioritizing smaller accounts, it'll de-emphasize some content that you want to see? I mean, is there a way that the algorithm can balance?
Absolutely. You know, we're not looking for a feed entirely comprised of small accounts. We want that harmony of, you know, your big news pages and your small commentators and everything in between. And I think that's really where the art of, you know, social media management comes in and these, you know, algorithms really can be tailored perfectly. They don't have to have over heavy-handed preference on big accounts or big-handed presence on small accounts. You really can have the perfect balance, and that's what we should be pushing for. I think Twitter previously did well. Given the shadow bans, all that, that's a whole different story. But day-to-day on Twitter, when it wasn't a politically controversial time, it worked. So I think we just kind of need to go back a little ways. We probably overcomplicated it and get back to the way the platform was built.
And I was speaking with Jake Denton, who is the tech policy advisor for the Heritage Foundation. And, speaking of tech policy, I mean, how much of this should be just the internal sort of tinkering of the platform itself? And if users prefer that Elon Musk allows free speech on X where the algorithms aren't as good on Meta, or if they end up, if they're somebody who prefers the algorithms on Meta, then they use those platforms more prolifically than X. Is this something that the free market should ultimately determine, or is this something that tech policy and the government should engage in, at least to an extent, when we're talking about things like digital bills of rights?
Well, if you remember in the week of the Twitter files, Elon open sourced the algorithm, and we began to see all of the different shadow ban mechanisms and things that Twitter had. And to this day, people still are poking around and finding out intricacies of the Twitter algorithm. And that should be common practice across all social media platforms. We should be open sourcing these algorithms so we understand what exactly we're interacting with. And that is a role for, tech policy. We should have standards for these platforms so that we're not just, flying blind with these companies. The power imbalance is where things go wrong. But when we talk about visibility, not just are people seeing it, but are the right people seeing it? Are they misdirecting your post? That only comes through open algorithms. So it's huge. I think ultimately that the free market side, people go to the platforms that work and that are fun. But really, we can't just have this duopoly where you either go to Instagram or X or TikTok or Instagram, for your short form or your media post. We need to have a more fruitful market where there's more options. We need to have more transparency.
Yeah, so well said. And in just the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Jake Denton, so Elon Musk has said openly that he would consider a position in the Trump administration. To me personally, I would love to see him stay on the outside and not, internal to government, because I think in the private sector he is doing and could do a lot more for the country in terms of free speech and all of those things. But what is your take on, that kind of an open sort of not ask, but just kind of a volunteering of Elon Musk saying, hey, I'm willing to at least help another Trump administration, or potentially even Kamala Harris, but the administration coming in.
For all of the wrongdoings of big tech and the things that they've really made our country a not so great place. We do need the expertise. We need these tech executives interested in governance because they really understand how to get manufacturing back online, how to, clear out a lot of the bloat in our government. We should be welcoming of, certain tech executives. Elon would be a great one in our government because, frankly, we don't have the expertise of management. We don't have the expertise of technology. It's too important to just box them out.
Yeah, well said. And, we'll see what happens. And hopefully either way the election goes, there will be some good opportunities for some good people. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Jerusalem, oh, Jerusalem, how many times I would have taken you under my wings. They had everything that was necessary for them to know Jesus and follow him, and they went their way.
I think for nations, for individuals, there is a day that you have to make the decision to respond to the Lord, and it might be that the door of opportunity after that shuts.
Exploring the Word, weekdays, 3 p.m. Central on AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we are barreling toward the November election, personal property rights, the economy, the stock market. I mean, all of these things are at the top of everyone's mind, and whether or not America will continue to have a good economy, whether we will have our rights protected, you know, all of these things. And so we want to take a moment to talk about the AFA Foundation. So let's welcome in Riley Wildman, who is the director of the AFA Foundation. And Riley, this is a great way that people can make sure that they can use their own personal property to go to a good ministry and for the Lord in the future. So tell us about the AFA Foundation and what you all do.
Having me on again this morning. The AFA Foundation just exists to what I would call leave a legacy to American Family Association, American Family Radio, and that is for, like you mentioned, property. We honestly don't do much property, but we do a what we call a charitable gift annuity. And I'll give your listeners kind of a brief overview of a charitable gift annuity. It's a simple contract between American Family Association and the donor where they can receive income coming back to them for the rest of their lives, and also receive a tax deduction the year that they set up the gift. And in return, they, like I said, they do receive income coming back to them for life, and that is based on their age and when they start receiving the income. The minimum amount, Jenna, is $2,000 or anything above that that they can give to the ministry. And once they pass away, anything left over is a gift back to AFA and AFR. So a charitable gift annuity is just a great tool that the foundation has, that we have several hundred people that have given away as a tool of a charitable gift annuity. I also would like to let your listeners know stock. We also have just an outright gift of stock that people can give to AFA and AFR. They can do that as well as a 100% tax deduction, or they can use the stock to fund a charitable gift annuity. So those are two big things that we have as well. And you were speaking about towards the end of the year and the election and everything. We also have a, we're kind of pushing this. A lot of people do not know this, and your listeners would probably like to know about this, but it's called an IRA rollover. That is just strictly, you have to be 70 and a half to fund that charitable gift annuity. So the donor would have to be 70 and a half. It would be a one-time IRA rollover to fund the charitable gift annuity. So yeah, so those are great, some great tools that we have that we have for the foundation.
And so when you mentioned the minimum for the charitable gift annuity, Riley, is $2,000. So how does a charitable gift annuity differ from just, say, a one-time donation of $2,000?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So as far as for that example, the $2,000, if somebody gifted just $2,000, like, for example, during Share-a-thon, or like you mentioned, just an outright gift, they would receive a full 100% tax deduction, Jenna, for that gift to AFA and AFR. So that $2,000 would be a straight outright gift, full 100% tax deduction. Whereas with the charitable gift annuity, if somebody gifted $2,000, you can have up to a one life charitable gift, I'm sorry, a one life or a two life. So you can have a single or a joint on that charitable gift annuity, and it would be $2,000, but they would not receive a 100% tax deduction, which would be 100% of the $2,000. It would be about, honestly, Jenna, one third, because they are receiving income coming back to them for the rest of their lives. So with the $2,000 outright gift to AFA, they're not receiving anything back. It's just a straight donation to the ministry. Whereas with the charitable gift annuity, it's about one third of a tax deduction that they would receive, and then they would receive income coming back to them for life.
Okay, so it seems like then with the one-time gift and that being, you know, fully tax deductible versus the foundation, which seems like it's more about long-term planning.
Yes, that is correct. It's more about long-term planning. It's more about the donor receiving income coming back to them for life, that they know that they have a fixed rate of return coming back to them for the rest of their life. And at the end of the day, when they pass away, that they know that they're continuing on the mission and the ministry of American Family Association.
And, you know, we are American Family Association is a donor-funded ministry. I mean, we're not a for-profit organization, and so rely on the charitable gifts of our donors. And, you know, as someone who loves AFA and who is very blessed to work for this organization, I so appreciate all of the donors and everyone who gives gifts during Share-a-thon and who gives those, you know, those one-time or even monthly donations that we rely on. And this type of opportunity through the AFA Foundation, I think, is just yet another great way to not only provide for the longevity of our ministry, but also really to give back and have this kind of long-term planning and legacy planning for donors. And so, so when you talk about the AFA Foundation and kind of the inception of why this was created, obviously as a benefit to the ministry, but it seems like this is a great opportunity and just an option for people that a lot of ministries don't have.
Right. Excuse me, Janet. Yes. Yeah, so it kind of started off, Pawpaw had started off several years, but it really started growing, I would say, back in 2010. When our former director, Diane O'Neill, and Dan Celia, who's gone along to be with the Lord, kind of took the foundation and kind of helped it grow. And so I would say, Jenna, it would be since 2010, since it was kind of, so to speak, first started. And it's here to, like I said, just leave a legacy to American Family Association through the donors. So the donors that contact us give through the charitable gift annuity.
And that makes sense. And so there is a whole host of information on afafoundation.net. That's afafoundation.net. Of course, you can also call in and speak with one of the great people, including Riley at the AFA Foundation, if you want to call in as well. But if you just want, you know, some information, you can go to afafoundation.net. There's the Giving Home tab, how to give, what to give, learn about wills, donor stories. So let's talk about that one and some of the donor stories. What have you seen in terms of just blessings to the ministry and the donors who've chosen to be part of the foundation?
Yeah, so as far as that's a good point on this, on our homepage, we do have donor stories, and those are just people that have given to the ministry that we have touched their lives, and we collect those stories throughout the year, and try to post those on our website so your listeners can go to afafoundation.net and look at those donor stories, and it'll touch their lives.
Yeah, and I was reading some of these, Riley, you know, head of the program today, and it's really incredible how AFA and the ministry have not only been prolific in hopefully worldview changes in our culture, but also in the lives of individual listeners and who then become donors. And I love hearing from listeners of this radio program when, you know, they learn something new, or they're just really excited about, you know, a story that we covered or a message that we shared or encouragement in scripture, because, you know, the reason that I love being part of AFR is that this isn't just about, you know, one political perspective. It's not just about covering the news of the day. Ultimately, this is about edifying all of our listeners through the truth of the gospel of Christ and promoting and fulfilling the Great Commission. And that is so important. And there are not enough ministries out there that are doing this. And I truly think, I mean, this is a function of what the church and the people of God should be doing. And I love this ministry, and I love to see how we have touched so many people's lives. I mean, for the listeners to know too, I mean, it's not just me serving here at the ministry. My own personal life has been touched in so many ways by people like Abraham Hamilton III, who I had on this morning, who's become just a very dear friend and
Your family, Riley, has just been so incredibly encouraging to me personally. I love you all so much, and it's just been such a blessing for me personally and in my walk with the Lord to be encouraged daily by the content that I hear on American Family Radio Network, and also by the friendships that I've developed with so many of the people that get to work in this ministry. And I'm so grateful for your family. So I would just encourage everyone who is considering a donation, whether that's one time or monthly, and we have Share-a-thon coming up. I'm excited to be back in Tupelo for that. But to go to afafoundation.net, just kind of see some of those options and, you know, maybe some closing thoughts, Riley. And thanks again so much for your participation in this ministry.
Thank you so much, Jenna. And thank you for having me on. And they can also give us a call at 800-326-4543. Again, that's 800-326-4543, extension 345, and we'll be glad to speak with them.
Wonderful. All right, and that website again is afafoundation.net, afafoundation.net, and we will be back tomorrow with more of the top trending headlines from a biblical worldview perspective. And always remember that worldview matters. Truth is our value. So go out and make it a great day for Christ, and you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.